Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young. Today's show features wild edibles. We'll make spicebush tea with fourth graders in southern Indiana and get some ideas for wild mushrooms from Chef Daniel Orr. Harvest Public Media brings us a story about farmers looking to sunflowers. And I'll talk to a filmmaker looking at the future of American agriculture through the eyes of young farmers. That's all just ahead on Earth Eats. And let's get started with some news from Mark Chilla. Hi there, Mark.
Hey there, Kate. First up, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, this week announced another $500 million in aid for Puerto Rico, more than half of which will pay to restore power and water. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate on Tuesday approved of a $36.5 billion spending package to keep aid funds flowing to Puerto Rico, Florida, Texas, and California. The bill passed on a vote of 82-17 after some wrangling over whether the bill should include reforms to old shipping restrictions. The Jones Act, which dates back to the 1920s, restricts shipments to U.S. ports to vessels built and run by Americans, regulations that some argue increases shipping costs from the mainland to Puerto Rico. Last week, Texas Senators John Cornyn and Ted Cruz threatened to hold up the vote on the disaster package, saying more money was needed for communities still recovering from Hurricane Harvey. In the end, they did not try to stall the vote. The spending plan still requires President Donald Trump's signature. And a bill that would make changes to the agricultural guest worker program has cleared its first hurdle and is headed to the floor of the U.S. House. U.S. agriculture producers say they can't find enough immigrant labor to pick vegetables and fruits and to work in meatpacking plants and feedlots. Enter the bill sponsored by Virginia Republican Representative Bob Goodlatte, which, among other things, would allow for more temporary farm workers. Democrats are concerned the changes will lower immigrants' pay and displace American workers. Washington Representative Pramila Jayapal says the proposed cap for 450,000 visas is misleading.
And the cap could increase depending on employer demand. And so this is really, we're talking about a massive number of people.
Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa believes the House will pass the bill, but that it will need bipartisan support in the Senate. Thanks to Erica Hunzinger of Harvest Public Media, as well as Chad Bouchard for these news stories.
And thank you, Mark Chilla.
Sure thing, Kate.
Our guest, Graham Merriweather, has a new film out called Farmers for America, debuting in Indianapolis at the Future Farmers of America Convention. The film tackles the future of agriculture in America with a focus on young farmers. But you might know Merriweather best from his first film, American Meat.
Basically, we looked at chicken, cattle, and hog production in America.
How did you move from that to the topic of your current film?
As I personally went to 220 screens around the country of American Meat. And so at those screenings, we were talking to young people and old people and middle-aged people all about agriculture all across rural America and urban America and suburban America. And the thing that people kept saying was that the young farmer issue was such a big issue. We kept hearing all these stories about young people. And so that's really what our film's about. It's all about young farmers, the challenges they face, the joys that they share in doing a job where they feed people.
And what are some of those challenges?
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges with land, especially if you aren't born into it or marry into it. It's almost impossible for a young person to get started farming. If you're going to have a farm, you need to have a combine. Combines are $500,000. You need to have a lot of acres in order to make enough money with the razor-thin margins on corn and beans. And so what that all adds up to is no young farmers are able to get in, and also no old farmers are able to get out. And so it's set up this really difficult situation where, because no young people can get started, the farms get bigger and bigger. That's also due to the technology getting more and more advanced and larger in scale. And so as no young people can get in and more farmers get squeezed out, then you have very few people left in rural America. And so you have the consolidation of high schools, you have the consolidation of lots of public services, and you got the main street breaking down, the hardware store closing down, the beauty parlor shutting up, and then the only thing left is a grain elevator and a post office. And that's where a lot of rural America is right now.
Well, I've been talking recently with some folks who are working with some land link projects and focusing on land transfers between farmers who are not related. What do you know about this movement, and is this a part of the film at all, or how do you think it fits in with the future of farming and young farmers' access to land?
I think it's super important. It's a huge part of potential solutions. We don't have any storylines with it in the film. I know there's some amazing stuff happening with the California Farm Academy, the Land Stewardship Trust in Minnesota. Pennsylvania has a really strong FarmLink program. So those are definitely a big part of the solution.
One of the things that might be included in your film, and you were talking about this a little bit, how land is typically transferred from one generation to the next through the family. And so that sort of means that people who haven't traditionally had access to land are going to continue to not have access to land. So I'm thinking African-American communities. I'm also thinking about how we don't usually think of women in the family being the ones who might be interested in taking over farms. So could we talk a little bit about issues of race and gender when it comes to farming and young farmers?
Absolutely. The first time I directed American Meat, it was almost entirely male and almost entirely white. And with this film, we've included a lot of farmers who are people of color. There's a really wonderful farm called Brother Nature in Detroit. And so we've filmed with Greg Willer and Olivia Hubert in Detroit at their farm. And it's actually one of the really cool solutions in the film, where they've taken over abandoned plots of land in Detroit, and they're growing lettuce and vegetables on a small scale and selling them at farmers markets that are less than a mile from their farm. So it's really cool. People of color and women are a big part of the future of agriculture, and we certainly included a lot of those stories in our documentary.
So your first film was called American Meat. This one's called Farmers for America. I've watched the trailer, and I was really struck by the patriotic imagery. The final moments of the trailer are some kind of freshly scrubbed white Midwestern teenagers singing the Star Spangled Banner at a football game, and the logo's red, white, and blue. Someone's even making American flags on their farm. So what's going on there with that?
Yeah, I guess pretty deeply ingrained. I'm definitely very patriotic in the sense that I love America and, proud of America. And I don't think that was conscious, but, American Meat, Farmers for America, I'm actually executive producing a documentary now called American Power. So, yeah, I definitely love America and love the American flag, love the national anthem. And so that's part of it, that this is a film that's excited about the past, the present, and the promise of American agriculture.
Who do you see as the audience for the film, or who do you think needs to see the film?
Well, we didn't apply to a single film festival, so I don't really care what Sundance thinks about this film or what the art film world thinks about this film. Where I'm sitting right now is in Indianapolis, Indiana, and it's the week of the National FFA Convention. And we chose to premiere the film here because we think this is the most important place for the film to start, which is that 65,000 young people are here learning about agriculture. They're young people in FFA, and they're interested in becoming farmers potentially. And so that's why we're bringing the film here. So the answer is that I want people who are interested in becoming farmers to see this film. I want to support young farmers. I want to celebrate young farmers, and that's our focus.
So you'll be traveling around the U.S. showing this film, and what kinds of conversations do you hope to spark in this film tour?
Well, for me, I really want it to be pro-farmer, so I'm not really interested in the organic GMO debate. I'm not really interested in Republicans or Democrats. I'm not really interested in a lot of the ways that we find to divide ourselves. What I am interested in is the fact that we are at a unique moment in America's agricultural history. Never before has half of America's farmland changed hands in a 12-year period. Never before has the average age of a U.S. farmer been 60 years old. And so we're at a unique moment, you know, and you ask what we're trying to get from those conversations. We're trying to support young people interested in agriculture. We're trying to have a constructive conversation about what America's next agriculture will look like.
What do you think attracts young people today to farming?
So the people who are first-generation farmers, who didn't grow up in farm families, I think for them it's a sense of purpose. There isn't much more clear-cut purpose than feeding people. When you're growing food and you sell that food directly to someone and then they eat that food and it keeps them going and keeps them alive, that's pretty cool, and you can see a very clear, tangible impact. It's also healthy. I mean, if you're outside, you're working with your body, working with your hands, you know, using your legs, using your chest, using your shoulders, it's a healthy, physical, active thing to be doing. And a lot of people are three or four generations removed from the farm, and they spend most of their day looking into a computer screen, checking their inbox, checking their Google Calendar, being on shared Google documents. They don't really get a chance to really feel like they're using their body for any purpose. And maybe they go to the gym and they walk up a stair climber that isn't going anywhere. They row on a rowing machine that isn't going across a lake. You know, and so I think when you're actually farming, you're actually planting the seed and growing things, there's a clear-cut sense of purpose in your life, and I think that's attracting a lot of young people who didn't grow up in farming.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today.
All right. Well, thank you, Kate. Have a good one.
That was Graham Merriweather, director of the film Farmers for America. I spoke with him just before the October 26th debut of the film in Indianapolis at the Future Farmers of America convention. If you'd like to set up a screening in your community, Leave It Better Media has a unique distribution process. They don't charge organizations for the film, but ask that the proceeds from ticket sales be evenly split between the filmmaker and the organizations hosting the screening. You can contact them at leaveitbetter.com. And you can always find out a little bit more about the stories you hear on Earth Eats. Links, recipes, photos, all that at eartheats.org. Sunflowers are a global commodity crop with a growing demand, though they're currently a minor player in the United States. Researchers have unlocked the genetic code of the entire plant, which could lead to better hybrid seeds, making sunflowers even more appealing to farmers. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, the flashy crop won't suddenly overtake the landscape.
Say what you will about the beauty of rows and rows of corn or wheat, they can't hold a candle to fields of blooming sunflowers. Bright yellow and cardinal red sunflowers bloom in late summer on research plots at Iowa State University.
We want to have that branching and that multiple flower head architecture.
Plant breeder Jessica Barb wants to understand more about their genetics. She carefully swipes a paper towel across the surface of a flower and transfers the pollen it picks up to a different one.
The pollen is being transferred from our little handy-dandy paper towel to actually the stigmas.
She's studying self-pollination because with fewer wild bees around, that's a feature that can help sunflowers survive. Barb wants to find the precise genetics that control it.
We're really interested in identifying those candidate genes so that we can help breeders guarantee that that trait is already present and so that they don't need bees.
Barb says her research is going to go faster now that the entire sunflower genome has been mapped. That's because a genome map, like a traditional map, offers landmarks and other features to help guide researchers to what they're looking for. Beyond pollination, the genome map will speed up breeding for other qualities that help improve the bottom line on the farm. Sunflowers, like all crops, have their foes. A fungus decimated the crop in 2010, taking out nearly 40% of it. South Dakota State University plant pathologist Fabina Matthew has worked since then to find ways to protect sunflowers from the fungus.
We want to know what genes get expressed when the pathogen infects the sunflower plant and what genes can be expressed as resistance when the pathogen infects.
If they can figure that out, companies may be able to develop hybrids that won't succumb to the fungus. Matthew says historically it has taken 15 years for discoveries like hers to reach farmers in the form of a new hybrid seed. With the mapped genome, she says,
that cuts back that 15 years to maybe 10 years probably, so we would be saving time there.
That might still sound like a long time, but farmers don't switch up their crops quickly because they need to feel confident they're not going to lose a lot of money on something new. Plus, sunflowers don't offer a wide array of markets as corn or soybeans do. About 80% of the sunflower harvest in the U.S. gets crushed into vegetable oil. The other 20% is for the baseball snack standard. Sunflower seeds are also used in baked goods, trail mix, what the industry calls confectionery.
What I think farmers are doing is they're looking for alternatives to grow different crops.
That's the National Sunflower Association's John Sandbachen.
And they're also looking for profitable crops. And sunflower has been a very profitable crop over the years and is something that producers have looked to add into the rotation just to give them some diversity.
Sandbachen says results vary widely, but generally, sunflowers are a bit cheaper to grow than some other plants, meaning farmers might squeak out a profit in years when they lose money on other seeds or grains. And just having sunflowers in the rotation offers soil health benefits. They have very long roots, so they can access water deep down in dry conditions that kill other crops. And while they're there, they can pick up valuable nutrients. That's something Brent Hulke from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's research office in Fargo, North Dakota, sees.
We found in cases where we've grown sunflower after a sustained period of corn-soybean rotation or corn-soybean-wheat rotation, that it finds nitrogen that other crops have left behind.
And the sunflower's roots create tiny tracks that may help the next crop stretch a little deeper. So in the right fields, sunflowers can be a moneymaker that also helps the environment. If that seems too good to be true, it might be. Because despite other benefits, farmers are only going to go for sunflowers if they can make money. And right now, aside from a band of states from North Dakota to Texas, most people don't live close to a processing plant, which means they'd lose money transporting the crop to market. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
For more where that came from, visit harvestpublicmedia.org. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personal financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Shane Gibson is the Director of Environmental Education with Sycamore Land Trust. He's been working with Sean Fisher's fourth grade class at Unionville Elementary, a public school just outside of Bloomington in southern Indiana. This school has developed a new curriculum this year called EARTH. It stands for Environment, Art, Resources, Technology, and Health. The new approach makes for an easy partnership with Gibson, who focuses on the environment but also on health. His visits include extra outdoor time for the kids and often a discussion on the nutritional aspects of edible wild plants. Today they'll take a walk past the playground down to their outdoor classroom. They're making spicebush tea together and sampling some pancakes made with acorn flour. On the walk, they'll be looking for wild edible plants.
I see some of you have your clipboards today, and I think that's a good idea, a clipboard or a notebook. I might just start talking about different types of plants, and you might just jot the name down of that plant, and then you may have time later to research more details. Anytime you're outside, it's a great time to make observations, and who knows what we might see. I've already seen some really awesome dragonflies at the pond. I saw turtles kind of cruising along the edge of the pond.
Just a few feet from the door of the building, Gibson stops and gathers the students for a quick lesson. He's just been to Bradford Woods for an adult education session.
They were thinking, we got to be at a place like Bradford Woods with all this wild area to find wild edibles. What I want you to know is that just like growing a garden in your backyard, wild edibles are right here, out your back door, at your feet, all around you. What is this right here? Say it again. Dandelion greens. Dandelions are very nutritious. Every part of the dandelion is edible. The roots, the leaf, the flower.
Next stop, under an oak tree.
An oak tree is one of the most beneficial trees to all wildlife, from the smallest insect to the deer to the to turkeys. I saw something recently that said it supports over 900 different species, the oak tree. So really, really important. And it was one of the most important, if maybe not the most important food for the early people in Indiana, the first people in Indiana, the American Indians. So something about acorns is that they have a bitterness in them from something called tannin. And tannin, how they get rid of that bitterness is to boil the acorns, throw out the water, boil them again, throw out the water, and that gets rid of the tannin. You could roast it, you could grind it, and make acorn flour or acorn meal, because I made acorn pancakes that we're going to try later.
I'm so excited for that tea, though. And the pancakes.
They arrive at the outdoor classroom, a clearing in the woods on the edge of a pond, with wooden benches arranged amphitheater style. Gibson has set up a makeshift outdoor kitchen equipped with a camp stove and pots of hot water. The kids take their seats on the benches.
What we're going to do today with the spice bush is to just put the spice bush in the hot water, let it steep, and then it'll be ready to drink. And with spice bush, you can make tea with the leaves, the twigs, the berries. The red berries, the Native Americans, there were two distinct flavors of the berry, where they would take the skin off, and that was one flavor, and then they would use the harder seed for another flavor.
Gibson lights the stove and heats up the water for the tea. The kids line up and snip leaves and branches from the spice bush into the hot water.
And we're going to try to do small.
Then it's time to taste some spice bush tea that Gibson made ahead of time, along with the acorn pancakes and maple syrup from his own trees.
And we'll just pass it on.
I go around to the fourth graders for an informal survey on the taste.
I think that it has a lot of texture in it, but with the maple syrup, it tastes a lot better.
It does taste like syrup.
It's pretty good. It's like the best thing I've ever tasted.
I mean, I ate it, but
the drink's really good. Mm-hmm. I just didn't like the acorn pancake.
I didn't either.
It's like too dry.
I like the tea. I just didn't like the other stuff. I thought it was too dry, like you did.
Yeah, the tea's amazing.
Yeah, the tea's good.
Did the maple syrup make it better?
No, not really. But the maple syrup was good, just the bread wasn't.
It was really good.
The tea's not good.
Which one, the tea?
Yeah.
I really love the acorn pancakes. They taste exactly like real pancakes or waffles. They're just so good.
I like it.
It tastes like water.
It tastes like cold water, but like sugary. It tastes pretty good.
It tastes like water, but with sweet added into it.
Just eat it.
That's good.
It's really good. I really like it. I think it's good.
Yeah, me too. I didn't really like the pancake that much, though.
I liked it with the syrup. It wasn't my favorite without the syrup, but with it was good.
It had a lemony taste to it.
Nature gives you a lot of nutrition.
I like the tea.
I don't think so. This is pretty amazing, guys. What do we say?
Thank you.
Shane Gibson is the Director of Environmental Education with Sycamore Land Trust in South Central Indiana. He offers educational programming in area schools on topics such as wild edibles, native plants, and wildlife. You can find out more at sycamorelandtrust.org. Speaking of wild edibles, Chef Daniel Orr has some tips to share about an edible mushroom often called chicken of the woods. If you're lucky, you just might find one of these tasty specimens on one of your autumn walks in the forest. They're not quite as difficult to spot as, say, the elusive morel, in part because of their bright yellow or orange color, and the fact that they're up a little higher, often on the bark of a tree. Let's go to the kitchen and see what Chef Daniel Orr can do with these.
What we do is we braise them. A lot of other mushrooms you wouldn't add this much liquid to, but these kind of slow cook, and they can tend to be a little bit dry, but when you cook them in a little bit of chicken stock or a little bit of vegetable stock, they absorb the moisture. You can finish it with a little bit of butter. And they have this really nice bright yellow bottom and kind of an orangey lobster shell colored top. And they keep in the refrigerator quite well for a week or two. So if you're lucky enough to find them, you can keep them around. You can also braise them off and freeze them and save them for Christmas time. These were found by a guy who works at FHB, the Firehouse Broadcasting, and he called me and said, what do I do with these mushrooms? So I told him, and he said, well, you know, it seems like a lot of work. Why don't you just have them? So I said, yeah, I'll take them. Yeah, it's wonderful. Throughout the year, different people call me. They'll have a tree full of cherries, or a churchyard had a pear tree in it, and nobody wanted the pears. So, you know, I was serving churchyard pears at the restaurant. So a lot of fun.
If you live in the Midwest, right now is the perfect time to look for these guys.
These are best in early October, mid-October, right around Halloween time. You also find things like puffballs at that time of year, which are also good. They're big, round, firm, white mushrooms, and you can slice those up and make like lasagnas, and I even make mushroom marshmallows out of those. I cube them and then deep fry them and then sprinkle them with a little bit of truffle oil, and they're just like explosions of mushrooms.
Of course, you'll find this recipe and scores of others on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from Needmore Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. NeedmoreRoasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. Thanks to the Earth Eats team, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Harvest Public Media, and Indiana University Food Institute. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and that's our show. We'll see you next time.